there is sure to be a tragic ending or two somewhere in the story. In the never-ending debate between nature versus nurture and their effect on the human mind, it's always fascinating to me to see how radically different the end results of seemingly similar starting cases can be. So it is with pancakes and biscuits. Take a look at the ingredients lists, and they're nearly identical. Flour, butter, baking powder, baking soda, and liquid dairy. But one ends up fluffy, tender, and relatively flat, and the other ends up tall, flaky, and crisp. The difference is all in the details. First off, biscuits are a dough, not a batter, which means that the ratio of flour to liquid is high enough that it can pull everything together into a cohesive ball that's soft but doesn't flow. Even more important is the way in which the butter is incorporated. With pancakes, the butter is melted and whisked into the batter, resulting in a sort of uniform tenderness. For great flaky biscuits, on the other hand, the butter is added cold and hard, and it's added before the liquid is. As you work the hard butter into the flour, you end up with a mealy mix comprised of small bits of butter coated in flour, some amount of a flour and butter paste, and some completely dry flour. Now add your liquid to this mix, and what happens? Well, the dry flour immediately begins to absorb water, forming gluten. Meanwhile, the flour suspended in the flour butter paste doesn't absorb any water at all, and, of course, you've still got your clumps of 100% pure butter. Kneading the dough will cause the small pockets of gluten to gradually link together into larger and larger networks. All the while, butter-coated flour and pure butter are suspended within these networks. As you roll the dough out, everything gets flattened and elongated. The gluten networks end up stretched into thin layers separated by butter and butter-coated flour. Finally, as the biscuits bake, a couple things occur. First, the butter melts, lubricating the spaces between the thin gluten sheets. Next, moisture from both the butter and the liquid added to the dough begins to vaporize, forming bubbles that rapidly increase in volume and inflate the interstitial spaces between the gluten layers, causing them to separate. Meanwhile, remember there's also baking powder and baking soda involved. This causes the parts of the dough that are made up of flour and liquid to leaven and inflate, adding tenderness and making the texture of the biscuits lighter. Folding. One of the keys to ultra-tender biscuits is not all that different from making light pancakes. Don't overmix. You want to knead the ingredients just until they come together. Overmixing can lead to excess gluten formation, which would make the biscuits tough. The other secret is to keep everything cold. If your dough warms up too much, the butter will begin to soften and become more evenly distributed in the dough. You want the butter in distinct pockets to help give the biscuits a varied, fluffy texture. There are a couple ways to help achieve these goals. First is to incorporate the butter using a food processor. A food processor's rapidly spinning blade will make short work of the butter, with little time for it to heat up and begin to melt. The method by which you incorporate the buttermilk is also important. Some folks like to do it by hand, others in the food processor. I find that the absolute best way is with a flexible rubber spatula, gently folding the dough and pressing it onto itself in a large bowl. Not only does the folding motion minimize kneading, and thus gluten, it also causes the dough to form many layers that will separate as they bake, giving you the flakiness you're after. For an extra boost of flakiness, I like to go one step further and make what's called a laminated pastry, pastry that has been folded over and over itself to form many layers. The doughs for classic French laminated pastries like puff pastry and croissants are folded until they form hundreds of layers. With my biscuit dough, I'm not quite so ambitious, but I've found that by rolling it out into a square and folding it into thirds in both directions, you create 9 distinct layers, 3x3. Roll the resultant package out into a square again and repeat the process, and you've got yourself a whopping 81 layers, 9x3x3. How's that for flaky? And guess what? A modern flaky American scone is really nothing more than a sweetened biscuit cut into a different shape. Master one, and you've mastered the other. Sticky buns. About once a year, whenever I feel that my marriage needs an artificial shot of undying devotion and true love, I'll wake my lovely wife up with the unmistakable scent of gooey sticky buns baking in the oven. I figure this act alone is enough to get me off the hook for a whole year's worth of minor marital infractions, or major ones, if I include a ramekin of orange cream cheese glaze for dipping on the side. Seriously, these things are awesome. Awesome enough that I decided to include them to wrap up this chapter, despite the fact that there's not all that much as far as new kitchen science goes here. Aside from minor tweaks to perfect the recipe, these sticky buns are pretty standard. But sometimes some minor tweaks is all it takes to perfect a standard. Rolling in dough. Sticky buns are made with what is called an enriched dough, meaning that in addition to the flour, water-based liquid, salt, and leavener found in most doughs, you've also got fat, in this case, eggs and butter. Ingredients like milk and yogurt provide both water and fat. The fat plays a vital role not only in the flavor of the buns, but also in their texture. In lean doughs made without fat, gluten formation is exceptionally strong because the flour proteins are easily able to come into direct contact with one another, rapidly forming a thick, sticky network of gluten. Because of this, lean doughs tend to have larger air bubbles trapped in them. Stronger gluten means the dough can stretch longer and thinner before bursting, as well as a tougher, chewier structure. With enriched doughs, the fats act like a lubricant, preventing proteins from bonding too tightly. Think of flour proteins as a group of hippie revelers forming a dance circle during a rare dry, sunny moment at Woodstock 1969. As they run into each other, they clasp each other's hands, as hippies are wont to do. Eventually, they're all linked together quite tightly. The circle can stretch out very far before any link breaks. Now, let's imagine the same group of hippies in the same field, but this time in the pouring rain. If coated, as they are, with mud and water, clasping hands tightly becomes much more difficult. Perhaps small circles form here and there, but they are nowhere the size and strength of the dry circle. So it is with fats. They prevent large hippie circles of flour from forming in your dough, so to speak. Because of this, enriched doughs tend to be more delicate than lean doughs, with a softer texture and smaller air bubbles. Of course, fats also add color and flavor to doughs. What fun would sticky buns be if they weren't golden and buttery? There are recipes for sticky buns that use chemical leaveners like baking powder to induce a rapid rise, but this technique compromises flavor. Yeast is the only way to properly develop flavor and texture in a sticky bun. See, yeasts, like pretty much all living creatures, have a strong desire to procreate, and in order to do that, they must consume energy. This energy consumption comes in the form of sugars, which they digest and let off as both carbon dioxide and alcohol, along with numerous other aromatic compounds. It's the carbon dioxide getting trapped in the network of gluten formed by the flour that acts to leaven yeasted baked goods. The process takes time, however. There's only so much procreating a yeast can do, you know? A properly leavened sticky bun dough can take several hours to produce. Well, why can't I just add more yeast to start, you might ask? The problem is that yeast has a flavor of its own, and it's not a particularly pleasant one. Start with a ton of yeast, and its slightly bitter, funky flavor will dominate the dough. The flavor of properly risen dough comes from the byproducts of the yeast's actions, the complex array of aromatic chemicals that are produced as yeast slowly, slowly digests the sugars in the dough. For the best flavor, you must start with a relatively small amount of yeast and allow it plenty of time to perform its magic. This is as true for sticky buns as it is for pizza dough or baguettes. If you've never made sticky buns, you'll probably find the process pretty much fun. You shape them by rolling a large piece of dough into a cylinder, then slicing it up to create shorter cylinders with a spiral pattern inside them. To keep these spiral layers separated from each other, a layer of butter and cinnamon sugar is spread over the flat sheet of dough before rolling it up. There are really no two ways about it. Sticky buns are a project involving multiple stages and plenty of time in the kitchen. Hey, didn't I tell you I only make these about once a year? But if my still-going-strong marriage is any indication, the results are definitely worth the effort. Hot chocolate mix. As a kid, I loved hot chocolate mix. I'd eat it straight from the packet, licking it greedily off my finger. I've never, however, liked it as it is meant to be served, mixed with hot water or milk. Thin and watery, too sweet or not sweet enough, with little chocolate flavor. While real homemade hot chocolate is not all that hard to make, dissolve cocoa in butter, add chocolate and sugar, maybe some vanilla and/or bourbon, add milk, and whisk while heating. You can't deny the convenience of simply stirring a few tablespoons of powder into a cup of hot milk. So I decided to come up with a homemade recipe that would match the convenience of a powder and beat it in terms of flavor and price. To start, I tried simply grinding chocolate to a powder in the food processor. Freezing it first makes this easy. While that made decent cups, by the time I'd added enough chocolate to the milk to get the flavor I wanted, the richness of the cocoa butter started to dominate, making drinking a full mug difficult. I opted instead for a combination of 100% cacao, unsweetened chocolate, sugar, and Dutch processed cocoa. With these tweaks, my chocolate was tasting pretty good, but a few problems remained. It caked in the storage container overnight, making it hard to dissolve the next day. It broke when added to the milk, dispersing a fine layer of fat bubbles over the surface of the drink, and the result simply wasn't rich, thick, and creamy enough. Many commercial mixes contain soy lecithin or dried milk proteins, both of which are intended to increase creaminess and help keep the milk fat, cocoa butter, and liquid nicely smooth and emulsified. I tried adding soy lecithin to my mix, and it worked, but I decided against it. It's available in health food stores, but hardly a commonplace ingredient. Milk powder also helped with texture, but it left the chocolate with a distinct cooked milk flavor. Not right. In the end, the simplest solution was to add some cornstarch to my mix. Not only did it prevent caking, it also thickened the milk, giving it a nice, smooth, creamy richness without adversely affecting flavor. 2. Soups, stews, and the science of stock. My wife hates the fact that our apartment always smells like food. She treats the glorious scents of sizzling burgers and roasting chickens like enemy combatants, using guerrilla tactics to hide jars of potpourri in places I'll never look, among the Russian literature, perhaps, or strategically disguised as one of the vacation souvenir knickknacks above her desk. As soon as I start a project in the kitchen, I await the familiar swish-clop of the window in the living room sliding open and the click-whirr of the fan switching on in her desperate attempts to preemptively ventilate. That's why rainy days are my favorite. You can't open the windows during a thunderstorm, which ensures that the awesome aroma wafting from my giant pot of chili slowly simmering away on the stovetop saturates the curtains and carpets. And it's there to greet you every time you enter the apartment for at least a few weeks. It lives on the bedsheets, ready to lull you to sleep like a warm glass of milk. It lingers on the shower curtain, greeting you every morning with its meaty, oniony aroma when you brush your teeth. My wife says I'm passive-aggressive. I tell her she's paranoid as I smile and heat up another bowl of chili. This chapter is all about those wonderful, apartment-saturating, aromatic stews, soups, and braises. The kind of food so good that you check the weather report just hoping for a hurricane warning. And it all starts with stock. Stock. 100 years ago, when French chef Auguste Escoffier, perhaps the most august of chefs, codified classical French cuisine, cooking was based on the production and use of stock, the rich, savory liquid produced by simmering animal matter, bones, and vegetables in water for a long time. Meats were braised in it, vegetables were glazed with it, soups and stews were built on it, and it was reduced into rich sauces. Stock was made from chicken, duck, turkey, beef, veal, pork, sheep, you name it. If it had four legs or feathers, it's a good bet that its bones and scraps would eventually find their way into a simmering pot. These days, stock isn't quite as essential. Cooking is lighter, and many restaurants get by with just chicken stock. At home, I use chicken stock exclusively, and my wife has yet to complain that my food just isn't French enough. For many recipes, even a good canned broth will do just fine, though you want to make sure that it's low sodium so that you can control the salt level yourself. Most regular canned stocks or broths are too salty to reduce into a sauce. There's still one place where a great stock is pretty much essential: soup. Like show dogs and children, soup can only be as good as the stock it's made from. Unfortunately, as anyone who's ever worked in a restaurant can tell you, making stock is a slow business. It can take hours to extract flavor and break down the connective tissue from a pot of chicken bones and scraps. This isn't a problem when you're in the kitchen all day anyway. Just keep a lazy eye on the huge stock pot on the back burner simmering away for 6 hours. But for a home cook, forget it. A couple Sundays a year, I'll give in and throw together a really traditional duck or veal stock. But for the other 363 days, I wanted to figure out a faster, better way. What's a chicken? As usual, I started with the basics, and in this case, the basics are a chicken. Once you've stripped away the feathers and the cluck, a chicken is actually a remarkably simple beast in culinary terms. Its matter can be divided into roughly four different parts. Muscle is what we think of as the meat on the chicken. It's the fleshy stuff that twitches and makes the bird go. And it can be further divided into two categories, slow twitch and fast twitch. Slow twitch muscles are meant for sustained movement. That is, the legs and thighs that keep the chicken standing, walking, and bending down or up. Because slow twitch muscles are aerobic, they require oxygen to function, they are typically dense with capillaries carrying oxygen-rich red blood cells. That's why they appear to be darker. Fast twitch muscles are used for short bursts of intense energy. They're the muscles that are found in chicken breasts, used to power the wings when a frightened chicken needs to escape from a dangerous situation. Because their activity is anaerobic, they don't require oxygen to twitch, they tend to be less dense with capillaries, giving them their characteristic pale color. Incidentally, the same distinction between fast and slow twitch muscles occurs in pretty much all animals, even humans. Ever wonder why a tuna is deep red while a cod is pale white? Tunas are made almost entirely of all-powerful slow-twitch muscles, which allow the fish to rapidly torpedo their way through the water for long periods of time. A cod moves only when he's eating or frightened. Fat provides insulation and energy storage for chickens. For humans, chicken fat just tastes delicious, provided it's cooked right. Fat is mainly found in large deposits around the legs and back of the bird, as well as in the skin. Contrary to popular belief, the skin of a chicken is not all fat. In fact, it's primarily made up of connective tissue. Composed of collagen, among other tissues, connective tissue is what keeps muscles attached to bones and bones attached to each other. In its natural state, it resembles a piece of yarn made of three separate strands that are tightly wound together, giving it lots of strength. Heat it up, and those strands unravel into gelatin, which can then form a loose matrix, giving stocks and sauces body and texture. Collagen is found everywhere, but it is particularly concentrated in the legs, wings, back, and skin of the bird. The older the animal, the more collagen there will be. Bone lends structure to the bird. Without bones, chickens would be little puddles of jello, and not all that appetizing. Many cooks believe that bones are what gives stock flavor. I'm skeptical. Listen on. Depending on the part of the chicken you use, these parts are present in different ratios. To sum up, chicken legs are high in slow-twitch muscle, have plenty of fat, and contain a good amount of connective tissue and bones. Breasts are almost completely fast-twitch muscle. Backs and carcasses have little meat of either kind, but plenty of bone, connective tissue, and fat. Wings have the highest concentration of connective tissue of all, with a high proportion of fat and some bone. To figure out exactly what each of these various tissues brings to the pot, I cooked a few batches of stock side by side, one made with just white meat, one made with just dark meat, one made with just bones, and one made with chicken carcasses, which have plenty of bones and connective tissue, but relatively little meat. After 4 hours of simmering, the meat-based stocks were flavorful, the one made with leg meat slightly more so than the breast, but had no body. Even when chilled to refrigerator temperature, these stocks remained a liquid, a sign that there was relatively little gelatin dissolved in the broth. The bones-only stock, as I suspected, was nearly flavorless, but it had a moderate amount of body. The stock made with carcasses was both flavorful and rich. This stock became a solid, rubber-like mass when chilled, due to the high amount of gelatin extracted in simmering. When sipped as a hot broth, it coated the mouth pleasantly, leaving the thin, sticky film on the lips characteristic of a good, rich broth. So carcasses are the way to go for the best balance between flavor and body. In a rare case of reverse economics, this also happens to be the cheapest way. You can accumulate carcasses by breaking down your own chickens, keep them in the freezer until you have enough to make a large batch of stock, or find them in most supermarkets at a bargain rate. But wings will do just fine if you can't get your hands on carcasses. So we now know that for the optimum broth, we need two things: extraction of flavorful compounds from within muscle fibers, as indicated by the broths produced from chicken meat, and the extraction of gelatin from connective tissue to provide body. The question is there any way to speed things up a bit? Well, I knew that chicken muscles look like long, thin tubes, and that extracting flavor from them is about slowly cooking them to extract their contents, much like squeezing a toothpaste tube. The degree to which those tubes are squeezed is dependent upon the temperature to which the chicken is brought, but the rate at which those flavors come out is also dependent upon the distance they have to travel from the interior of the muscles to the stock. So, I wondered, would shortening the length of those tubes hasten the flavor extraction process? I cooked three stocks side by side using chicken carcasses chopped to different degrees and found that indeed it does make a difference. Chopped carcasses gave up their flavor far faster than whole carcasses, and throwing roughly chopped chicken pieces into the food processor and finely grinding them worked even faster, producing a full-flavored broth in just about 45 minutes. It ain't pretty, but hey, it works. But here's an interesting thing. Although chopping the bones into pieces increased the rate of flavor extraction, it didn't have nearly as much impact on body development. Flavor extraction is a fast process. It's all about getting stuff out from inside the meat and dissolved in the water. Getting the gelatin out, on the other hand, requires not just extraction of the collagen. It is a chemical process that takes time, no matter how finely that collagen is chopped. Remember how collagen looks like a twisted piece of yarn? Have you ever tried separating the separate strands in a piece of yarn? It's possible, but time-consuming. And that's exactly what's going on in a pot of simmering connective tissue. At 190 degrees to 200 degrees Fahrenheit simmer, it takes about 3 hours for 90% of the connective tissue to convert to gelatin, and then about an hour more for all of it to convert. Continue cooking past that point, however, and the gelatin itself starts breaking down, losing its thickening power. So the ideal chicken stock should be simmered for around 4 hours. Luckily, chicken collagen isn't the only place where you can find gelatin. In fact, it's sitting right there in the supermarket. Packaged gelatin, the same stuff that makes Jell-O jiggly, is commercially available in powdered or sheet form. So all I had to do was take my 45-minute simmered chopped carcass broth and add commercial gelatin to it to produce a stock that was not only flavorful as one that had been simmered for hours, but just as rich. So that's it, right? Stock in 45 minutes? Well, wait. What if we could make our stock taste even better than a traditionally made French-style stock? Not possible, you say? I'll prove it. In a traditional French stock, clarity is valued above all else. It's fat and dissolved minerals and proteins, which we'll collectively call by their scientific name, gunk, that make broth cloudy. If you keep a stock at a bare simmer, the fat rises to the surface in distinct bubbles that can be carefully skimmed off as it cooks, and the proteins coagulate into relatively large agglomerations that can be strained out. But let your broth simmer vigorously, or, mon Dieu non, actually come to a boil, and that gunk gets dispersed into millions of tiny droplets that simply can't be completely removed from the broth. It can spell disaster in a fancy restaurant, where sauces and soups must be perfectly glossy and crystal clear. But do we really care about that at home? I, for one, will take flavor over appearance any day of the week, and fat is flavor. A bonus to grinding up the chicken bones and scraps before making stock is that all the ground-up bits form a sort of floating raft that will collect stray proteins, minerals, and other gunk, exactly the same way that a French consommé is made. This helps solve part of the clarity problem. The rest of it, we can live with. Moral of the story, let your stock simmer away. Experiment. Fat equals flavor. It's not intuitive, but most of the flavorful compounds that give various types of meat its distinct flavor are not in the meat itself, but in the fat that surrounds and runs through it. Don't believe me? Just think of this. Why is most lean meat described as tasting like chicken? It's because without fat, meat has a very generic flavor. It does taste like a lean chicken breast. If you've got a food processor or meat grinder at home, you can even prove this to yourself with this experiment. Materials: 12 ounces boneless lean beef, a cut like eye of round or well-trimmed sirloin will do well, cut into 1-inch cubes. 1 ounce beef fat, trimmed from a steak, or just ask a butcher for some beef fat, cut into small pieces. 1 ounce lamb fat, trimmed from a lamb chop, or just ask the butcher for some lamb fat. 1 ounce bacon, cut into small pieces. Procedure. 1. Divide the beef into 3 portions, and toss each portion with a different fat. 2. Using a food processor or meat grinder, grind the meat into hamburger. 3. Form each portion into a patty and cook in a hot skillet or on the grill. 4. Taste the cooked patties. Results. How did the cooked patties taste? Most likely you found that the first patty tasted like a regular burger, while the second patty tasted like a lamb burger. The bacon-laced patty, well, you get the gist. Still unconvinced? Try the same thing replacing the lean beef with lean lamb. The patty with beef fat will still taste very much like a regular all-beef burger. Defatting a stock. In most situations, outside of fancy restaurants and fashion shows, a little extra fat is not necessarily a bad thing. Go to any Japanese ramen house, for example, and they'll actually add fat to individual bowls of noodles for extra flavor. But there's a big difference between just enough and too much. A bit of fat emulsified into a broth and a few stray bubbles floating on the surface add richness and depth. A heavy slick adds nothing but a greasy flavor and mouth-coating oiliness. So it's best to remove the slick of fat that forms on the top of your stock as it cooks. But what's the best way? If you've worked in a restaurant, you've probably been taught to be hyper-aware of what your stock is doing at all times, carefully skimming any scum or fat that rises to the surface at regular intervals to keep the broth as clear as possible. But, again, that's a restaurant technique for restaurant cuisine. When I make stock at home, I don't bother skimming it until it's finished. I strain the stock through a fine mesh strainer into a fresh pot and let it rest for about 15 minutes, long enough to allow most of the fat and scum to rise to the surface so it can be easily ladled off. Even easier is to plan ahead and refrigerate the stock overnight. The fat will crystallize into an easy-to-remove layer that can be scraped off with a spoon, exposing the perfectly gelled stock underneath. Stock, broth, glace, and jus. Strictly speaking, stock and broth are two distinct preparations. Stock is made by simmering bones, connective tissue, meat scraps, and vegetables in water. The connective tissue gives it body and a rich, unctuous mouthfeel. Reducing a stock by gently heating it to evaporate its water content concentrates both its flavorful compounds and its gelatin. Reduce it far enough, and it'll become viscous enough to form a coherent coating on food. At this stage, it's known as a glace, and it's exceedingly delicious. Just as Eskimos have many words for snow, the French have different words for reduced stock: glace, glace de viande, and demi-glace, according to how far the stock has been reduced. Broth is made with meat and vegetables, no bones or connective tissue. It can be flavorful, but without collagen from connective tissue, it's about as thin as water. Yet while a classically trained chef may need to know this distinction, as a home cook, you don't have to worry about it. In this book, I use the word stock pretty much exclusively, because my quick chicken stock recipe contains both bones and added gelatin. For the vast majority of home-cooked recipes, the two can be used interchangeably. The USDA makes no distinction in their labeling laws about what can be called stock or broth. They state that the terms may be used interchangeably as the resulting liquid from simmering meat and/or bones in water with seasonings. While some brands will choose to use one wording or another on their packaging, there is in fact no real difference in how they're manufactured. Jus refers to the natural juices given off by a piece of meat that's been roasted. Often the jus will settle on the bottom of a roasting pan and evaporate while the meat cooks, leaving a coating of what is called fond, the delicious browned bits that form the base of pan sauces and gravies. Freezing stock. There's no denying it. Even a quick stock is a bit of a chore, and one that I don't want to go through every time I make a bowl of soup or need a quick pan sauce. Fortunately, stock freezes remarkably well. I keep my stock frozen in two different ways. In ice cube trays. Pour the stock into an ice cube tray, let it freeze completely, and then transfer the cubes to a Ziploc freezer bag. You can pull out as much or as little as you need, and the cubes melt nice and fast. This is ideal for pan sauces, where you don't need too much stock at a time. In quart-sized cryovac or freezer bags or plastic containers. If you have a vacuum sealer, such as a food saver, a quart-sized bag is the ideal way to store stock. It freezes flat, so it takes up very little space in the freezer, and, better yet, defrosts under hot tap water in just a matter of minutes. If you don't have a vacuum sealer, you can freeze stock in Ziploc freezer bags. Make sure to squeeze out as much air as possible before sealing them, then lay them flat to freeze. Or just use regular plastic deli containers. The other trick to efficient and inexpensive stock production is to save all your chicken parts. Every time I break down a chicken, I toss the backs and wingtips into a gallon Ziploc bag that I keep in the freezer. When the bag is full, I'm ready to make a batch of stock. Chicken soup with rice or noodles. As a hardcore Colombian from the mountains of Bogota, my wife claims that she could live on soup alone. My naturally inquisitive mind is plagued by the strong urge to rigorously test this claim, but every time I decide to force her to embark on the first day of the rest of her liquid diet-based life, the part of me that loves her intervenes and reminds me that life just wouldn't be as fun without her, soup or no. She, coming from a rice-eating country, prefers rice in her soup, while I, coming from New York, prefer the superior egg noodle. I have generations of Jewish grandmothers on my side, but she has the trump card of Maurice Sendak. Though I do like to point out that had there been more words in the English language that rhyme with noodle, Sendak may well have written a different set of poems entirely. As it is, in January, while I doodle swirly patterns on my poodle, doesn't have quite the same ring to it as the original. That said, we do eat a lot of soup around here, and once you've got a great chicken stock to work with, you've won 99% of the battle for the ultimate vegetable chicken soup with rice, or noodles. The rest is as simple as adding the vegetables and rice, or noodles. I like to start with a base of carrots, onions, and celery, then mix it up. Whatever's in season, whatever looks best, heck, whatever you can get your hands on and feel like adding, is the best strategy here. The key to remember is that different vegetables need to be prepped and cooked in different ways in order to maximize their soup-worthiness. Beef and barley stew. When you grind as much meat as I do, you often find yourself with an extra pound or two of short ribs lying around. You could braise them in red wine and be all French, or you could cook them for a few days sous vide like a modern restaurant, and both are great techniques. Sometimes, though, I'm in the mood for something simpler. Short rib and barley stew is fantastic because it is dumb easy to do, is made with pantry and fridge staples, aside from the short ribs, lasts for days and gets better with time, soothes the soul or warms the cockles of your heart, or, if you're really lucky, both at the same time, and tastes really, really good. The method is pretty straightforward. Sear the meat to add a bit of flavor, sauté the vegetables, and then simmer the whole thing down with a bit of Marmite, soy sauce, and tomato paste added for that umami kick. Throughout the winter months, there are usually a few leaves of kale kicking around my fridge, since they make such a great salad. Just marinate in olive oil and vinegar for a couple of hours. It stays crisp for days even after dressing. And they go a long way in making this stew even tastier and heartier. If you prefer beef and barley soup to stew, just add some more stock at the end to thin it to the desired consistency. Where's the beef? Stock. You may be wondering why I use chicken stock in my beef soup rather than beef stock, and the answer is simple. I'm lazy. Beef bones are large, and it takes a long, long time to extract flavor and gelatin from them. Restaurants will keep them simmering on a back burner all day. Chicken stock is quick. I usually have it on hand, and it has a nice neutral flavor that can easily pick up other flavors without overwhelming them. A beef stew made with chicken stock as the base will still be plenty beefy once it's done simmering. What about store-bought broth? On most supermarket shelves, you'll find chicken, beef, and vegetable broth, all for about the same price. But that doesn't make sense, does it? If beef broth takes so much more effort, bigger bones, longer extraction times, more expensive meat, how can they sell it for the same price as chicken broth? Here's the secret. Store-bought beef broth is not really beef broth. There is actually very little beef in canned beef broth. Just like other humans, food manufacturers are lazy and concerned about their bottom line. Rather than spending all day simmering veal or beef bones, they opt to use natural and artificial flavorings. According to the USDA's labeling guidelines, beef or pork broth only has to have a moisture protein ratio, MPR, of 135.1 to 1. That is, for every ounce of water, there is only 0.007 ounce of beef protein present. No wonder the broths don't taste much like meat. To quickly and cheaply boost the flavor of canned beef broth, most manufacturers rely on yeast and vegetable extracts. While yeast extracts are great for adding a savory boost to your stews, I'd much rather have control over its addition myself. Many of my recipes call for Marmite, a yeast extract. If you're going to go canned, go with low-sodium chicken broth. Shopping for broth. Always buy chicken or vegetable broth, not beef. Here are a couple tips for what to look for in a canned broth. Buy low-sodium broth. This will allow you to adjust the seasoning to your taste instead of being tied to the usually very high salt levels of the canned broth. Buy broth in resealable Tetra Paks, not cans. Like many packaged foods, broth will start going bad as soon as you open it. A resealable Tetra Pak will help prolong its lifetime, allowing you to use as little or as much as you need while storing the rest in the fridge. How to make canned beans taste good. I love beans, and my wife loves soup, which makes winter a great time of the year for both of us. Well, not exactly. The reality is that my wife loves soup, and I love whiskey. It's a would-be serendipitous situation for both parties involved, considering how often the spirit moves me to make soup when I'm tipsy. I accidentally made soup again, dear, I tell her. I say would-be because my wife seems to prefer my sober soup to my drunk soup, even though the latter always tastes better to me. So this year I decided that I love beans almost as much as I love whiskey, and that I love my wife significantly more than I love either. And so I would trade in the bottle for the legume, and drunk soup for bean soup. Of course, with the cold weather and lack of spirits, I was ready to get cracking right away. Problem is, dried beans are not exactly fast food, taking at best several hours, and at worst, a full day of soaking followed by simmering. So I did what any sensible, sober man would do. I bought them canned. There are a couple of distinct advantages that canned beans have over dried. For one, their texture is pretty much always spot on. Bean canners have got the process down to an art, and you'd now be hard-pressed to open a can and find beans that were broken, chalky, hard, or anything short of perfectly creamy and intact. Not always an easy thing to accomplish at home. For another thing, canned beans come with some nice, full-bodied liquid. Many recipes tell you to rinse the stuff off. That makes sense if you're making, say, a bean salad, but the liquid is awesome in soups, adding flavor and body to an otherwise thin broth. There's only one real problem with canned beans: flavor. With dried beans, you have the option of cooking your beans in any number of media: water, chicken stock, pork broth, dashi, a sweet molassesy tomato sauce, and adding whatever aromatics you like: onions, carrots, celery, bay leaves, thyme, pork fat, in order to get flavor built right into them. Canned beans, on the other hand, are designed to have a neutral flavor that will work moderately well in any dish, but shine in none. Luckily for us, there are means to getting a bit of flavor back into those guys. Most simple canned bean soup recipes call for mixing the ingredients together, bringing the soup to a boil, and serving it immediately. There's no fault in doing that. Canned beans, after all, are a convenience food. But what if I told you that by adding a ton of flavorful aromatic ingredients and a quick 15-minute simmer, you could amplify the quality of your soup by an order of magnitude? Okay, no dramatic drumroll there, I guess. Let's be honest. These are 30-minute bean soups. They aren't going to change your life the way, say, buying your best friend a lottery ticket that happens to be worth millions of dollars would, but they may well change your weeknight cooking routine. How to make creamy vegetable soups without a recipe. When I was a totally green cook with my first serious restaurant job, working under Chef Jason Bond at what's now a landmark Boston restaurant, Number 9 Park, there were many moments when I learned a new technique or perfected an old one and said to myself, "Holy crap, I just made this?" But the very first was when Chef Bond taught me how to make a creamy chanterelle soup, read Campbell's Cream of Mushroom Soup on Tasty Tasty Crack, sweating aromatics, sautéing mushrooms, adding a good stock, and pureeing it, all while emulsifying the mixture with fresh butter. Like any great vegetable soup, the end result was something that tasted like a liquefied, purified, intensified version of itself. This soup tasted more like chanterelles than actual chanterelles. The magic lies in the way that aromatic ingredients can bring out other flavors, as well as the way in which liquids coat your mouth, giving more direct contact to your taste buds and olfactory sensors, and making for easier release of volatile compounds. These days, there aren't too many vegetables in the world that I haven't made into a smooth, creamy soup, and there are even fewer that I've not loved. But my experience has taught me something. That first process of making a chanterelle soup wasn't really just a recipe for chanterelle soup. It was a blueprint for making any creamy vegetable soup. You just need to break it down into its individual steps and figure out how to universalize them. Let's say, for instance, that I've never made a smooth carrot soup flavored with ginger and harissa, but I really like the idea. Here's how I'd go about it. Step 1. Prepare your main ingredient. The simplest soups can be made by merely adding your main ingredients raw and simmering them in liquid later on. When preparing this type of soup, all you've got to do is get your main ingredient ready by peeling it, if necessary, and cutting it into moderately small pieces. The smaller you cut, the quicker your soup will cook down the line. There are times when you may want to boost the flavor of a main ingredient by, say, roasting or browning it. This is an especially effective technique for sweet, dense vegetables like sweet potatoes and squashes, or brassicas like broccoli or cauliflower, all of which intensify in sweetness with some browning. To roast them, cut them into large chunks, toss them with some olive oil, salt, and pepper, set them in a baking sheet lined with aluminum foil or parchment paper, and roast in a 375-degree Fahrenheit oven until tender, with their edges tinged brown. This works in two ways. First, the process of caramelization breaks down large sugars into smaller, sweeter ones. Second, enzymatic reactions that create simple sugars are accelerated with heat. Step 2. Choose your aromatics. Alliums, onions, leeks, shallots, garlic, and the like are like the best supporting actor of the soup pot. They're not there to steal the spotlight, but without them, your soup would be boring. Nearly every soup I make starts with either onions or leeks, along with some garlic or shallot, and sometimes all four, cooked down in olive oil or butter. Other firm vegetables, such as diced carrots, bell peppers, celery, thinly sliced fennel, or ginger, can work well in certain situations, but they tend to have a stronger impact on the finished flavor of the dish, so make sure that you really want them there. Make a carrot soup with just onions, and it'll taste like carrot soup. Make a carrot soup with fennel or ginger, and it will taste like carrot and fennel soup or carrot and ginger soup. Step 3. Sweat or brown your aromatics. Next big question, to sweat or to brown? Sweating is the process of slowly cooking chopped vegetables in a fat. You do it over moderate heat, and the goal is to get rid of some of the excess moisture within those vegetables and to break down their cellular structure so that their flavor is released. With the case of alliums, there's another process going on. Onion aroma is created when certain precursor molecules that exist within separate compartments in onion cells break out and combine with each other. Sweating an onion will break down cell walls, allowing this process to happen. The same holds true for garlic, shallots, and leeks. Browning starts out like sweating, but generally takes place over higher heat. Once excess liquid from vegetables has evaporated, the vegetables can begin to brown and caramelize, creating rich flavors, more sweet notes, and more complexity. You might think that more flavor is always better, and thus you should always brown your vegetables. But more often than not, this browning can be overpowering, making soups too sweet or competing too much with the subtler flavors of your main vegetable. Step 4. Add second-level aromatics like spices and pastes. After your aromatics have sweated or browned, the next phase is your secondary aromatics, and it's an optimal stage that's often omitted. If you like very clean, pure-tasting soups, jump ahead. If you like playing with flavors and spices, then you'll have fun with this step. These are things like ground spices say curry powder, ground cumin, or chili powder, and moist pastes like tomato paste, harissa, or chopped chipotle peppers in adobo sauce. These types of ingredients benefit from a brief toasting or frying in hot oil, which alters some of their constituents into more complex, more aromatic products, as well as extracting fat-soluble flavors so that they disperse more evenly into the soup. Because ground spices have such a high ratio of surface area to volume, and most pastes have already been cooked, the process takes only a few moments, just until the spices start smelling fragrant. Step 5. Add your liquid. Your choice of liquid can have a big impact on the finished dish. Chicken stock is an easy fallback and always a good choice. It has a neutral, mild flavor that adds meatiness and savoriness to a dish without overwhelming any flavors. Likewise, vegetable stock can bring similar complexity, though buyer beware. Unlike store-bought chicken broth, most store-bought vegetable broths are vile. You're better off making your own. Vegetable juice is what you want if you value intensity of vegetable flavor over balance. Carrots cooked and pureed in carrot juice will taste insanely carroty. You can buy many vegetable juices at the supermarket these days, or juice your own with a home juicer. Mixing and matching a main ingredient with a different vegetable juice, like in my recipe for roasted squash and raw carrot soup, can lead to great end results. Dairy, such as milk or buttermilk, is a good way to get yourself a heartier, creamier dish, though dairy fat does have the tendency to dull bright flavors. This is not necessarily a bad thing. Dairy is the perfect foil for the intense flavor of broccoli in a creamy broccoli soup, or tomatoes in a cream of tomato soup, for instance. Water is a perfectly fine choice if the other options aren't available. Whatever liquid you choose, don't use too much. Use just enough to cover your ingredients by an inch or so. You can always thin a thick soup out after blending, but reducing a pureed soup that's too thin is a much more difficult thing to do if you don't want to risk burning it to the bottom of the pot. After adding your liquid and main ingredient, bring the soup to a simmer and let it cook until the vegetables are just cooked through. You want them to be just tender enough to pierce with a knife with no resistance. For things like carrots, parsnips, and other root vegetables, you have a bit of leeway. Overcooking won't be the end of the world. But for bright green vegetables like broccoli, asparagus, peas, string beans, or leafy greens, you want to make sure to stop cooking them before they start turning a drab green color. If a brightly colored soup is something you care about, that is. Step 6. Puree and emulsify. Here's the fun part, pureeing. The smoothness of your final soup will depend on the tool you use. A blender will give you the smoothest result due to its high speed and vortex action. When blending hot liquids, always hold the lid down with a kitchen towel, start the blender on low speed, and slowly bring it up to high, unless you enjoy wearing hot soup. An immersion blender can give you a decently smooth result, depending on the power of your blender. It's by far the most convenient way to make soup, and it's a good choice if you're fine with a rustic, kind of chunky texture. A food processor should be your last choice. Because of its wide base and relatively low spinning rate, a food processor does more chopping than pureeing. Whatever the pureeing method, I like to emulsify my soup with some fat during this stage, either butter or olive oil. This adds a rich texture to the soup. Some recipes, including many of mine, will tell you to slowly drizzle in fat or add butter a knob at a time while the blender is running, which is a surefire way to get your fat to emulsify properly. But here's a secret. So long as you don't have the world's worst blender, and somebody out there does, there's no real need to drizzle in the fat slowly. The vortex action of a blender is plenty powerful enough to emulsify the fat, even if you just dump it in all at once. If the ultimate in smoothness is your goal, finish off your pureed soup by using the bottom of a ladle to press it through a chinois or an ultra-fine mesh strainer. The end result should be smoother than John Travolta strutting with a double-decker pizza slice. Step 7. Finish with acid and season. Seasoning is the final step just before plating and serving in any recipe. You can season as you go, but you never know if your soup has the right level of salt until you taste it in its final form. Now is the time to do that. Equally important to bring out the best flavor in a recipe is acid. Because acidic ingredients quickly dull in flavor when cooked, it's best to add fresh acid right at the end, just before serving. For most vegetable-based dishes, lemon juice or lime juice is a great option, as their aroma complements vegetal flavors. Other good options would be a dash of cider vinegar, wine vinegar, or my favorite, sherry vinegar. The latter goes particularly well with soups made with plenty of extra virgin olive oil. Step 8. Garnish and serve. Your soup is essentially done at this stage, but a little garnish never hurt anybody. Here are some options. Flavorful oils like walnut, pistachio, squash seed, or argan. Chopped fresh herbs or tender alliums like parsley, tarragon, chives, or sliced scallions. Sautéed vegetables like mushrooms, leeks, or garlic. Nuts like almonds, hazelnuts, or pine nuts, toasted in olive oil or butter. Simple gremolata-style mixtures like a blend of parsley, lemon zest, and grated garlic. Thinly sliced chilies. A drizzle of browned butter. Dairy products like sour cream, creme fraiche, or heavy cream, plain or flavored with spices or pastes. Using a hint of the same spice you used earlier in step 4 can be a good way to boost flavor. I think of the garnish as a final step to layer flavor and/or texture into the bowl. Step 9. Rinse and repeat. Once you've got these 8 basic steps down, you've got what it takes to start creating any number of creamy soups, combining any flavors you like. I'm not promising that every single combination of vegetables and aromatics will work out, but use this guide as a blueprint, and you're well on your way to building the soup of your dreams. We all dream about soup, right? Boom goes the blender. Here's a scenario that happened to me just last week. I was making a batch of tomato soup for my wife, who can't get enough of the stuff, and I'd just dumped the hot tomato mixture into the blender. As I reached for the on button, a tiny voice in the back of my mind said to me, "All of this has happened before, and all of it will happen again. Ask yourself this question: would an idiot do this? If the answer is yes, then do not do this thing." Of course, I went ahead and turned on the blender anyway. The top popped off in a violent explosion, and my dog leaped behind the couch in fear as hot tomatoes splattered across the apartment with all the fury of a VEI-7 volcanic eruption. This kind of stuff happens because there are some mistakes I never learn from, and, more important, because of thermodynamics and the physics of vapor formation. See, there are a number of factors involved in the conversion of hot water to steam. Pressure is a big one. As we all know, steam takes up much more space than water. Because of this, if you apply enough pressure to a body of water, steam will not escape. When a big batch of tomato soup is sitting in a blender, there is significant pressure on all of the soup except the stuff at the surface. Steam escapes from the top alone, while the liquid below the surface sits there patiently waiting its turn. Switch on the blender, though, and suddenly you create tons of turbulence. A vortex is formed. The surface area of that body of liquid suddenly becomes much bigger, and steam is rapidly and violently produced. Moreover, the added exposure will also heat up the air in the headspace of the blender, causing it to expand. This rapid expansion causes the top of your blender to pop off and the hot tomatoes to go flying. Boom! So, how do you prevent it? There are 2 ways. First off, make sure that there's room for expansion in the blender. The hot steam needs an escape valve. The easiest thing to do is to remove the central plug in your blender top and cover the hole with a towel. This will allow expanding gases to escape, but prevent liquids from flying out. The second and easier way to prevent blowout is to start blending very gently. Start your blender at the lowest speed and slowly work your way up to the highest. Expansion will take place more slowly, allowing the gases plenty of time to escape and enabling your kitchen and your dog to get away unharmed. Straining. If velvety smooth and lump-free are terms that you'd like to be able to use to describe your soups and sauces, a fine mesh strainer is your tool of choice. But have you ever poured a batch of soup into a strainer set over a pot or bowl and waited for it to all pass through? Chances are, you ended up waiting a long, long time. As the soup passes through, the holes in the strainer get clogged. There are two solutions to this. The first is the wrap. Holding the soup-filled strainer above your container with one hand, wrap a long, heavy tool repeatedly against the edge of the strainer with your other hand. I use a heavy spatula or a honing steel. Soup should flow out of the bottom with each wrap. For extra thick or chunky soups, I use a second method, the spoon press. Holding the soup-filled strainer above your container with one hand, stir the contents using a large metal serving spoon, a ladle, or a rubber spatula, scraping the edge of the utensil against the mesh. This should force seeds, lumps, and other clog-inducing material out of the way so your soup can flow freely. Quick tomato soup with grilled cheese. Is there any rainy day fare more classic than tomato soup and grilled cheese? It's quick, it's easy, it's filling, and it just takes you back to feeling like a kid again, if you ever left that stage in the first place. Of course, there's the classic Campbell's tomato soup in a can, which, like a puppy that won't stop licking your face, is cloyingly cute and enjoyable up to a point, but sometimes what you want is the adult version. Luckily, making it is almost as simple. This version uses whole canned tomatoes, pureed with a mixture of sautéed onions, oregano, and red pepper flakes, which gives it just the right amount of flavor and heat to bring balance to the dish. As with chili, adding a splash of liquor to the soup just before serving helps its aroma pop out of the bowl and into your nose, where it belongs, though it'll do fine without it. A drizzle of high-quality olive oil and a sprinkling of fresh herbs transform this childhood classic into a downright elegant lunch. Make sure you put on a tie and jacket before consuming. As for the grilled cheese, everyone knows how to make grilled cheese, right? The key is plenty of butter and low and slow cooking. Cook it too fast, and your toast burns long before the cheese has had a chance to get even remotely gooey. That's how I'd been cooking my grilled cheeses for years, until my friend Adam Kuban showed me a better way. His trick: toast two slices of bread in butter, then add the cheese to the toasted side of one slice before closing the sandwich and proceeding as normal. The hot toasted bread not only adds buttery richness and extra toasty flavor to the interior, it also helps get the cheese started on its way toward glorious gooiness. The cheese you use is really up to you, but I do admit that just like in my cheeseburgers, I like my grilled cheese with the meltiness of American. A good compromise is to use one slice of American for the goo factor and an extra slice of a more flavorful sharp cheddar or Swiss, or if you want to be really fancy, Gruyere. Finally, if you want to go full cheese on this one, I like to add a layer of microplaned Parmigiano Reggiano to the exterior of my sandwich. It crisps up like an Italian frico in the skillet, giving you an extra layer of cheesy crunch. Corn chowder. My mother's corn chowder recipe involved a can of creamed corn, an equal amount of half and half, and a teaspoon of chicken bouillon. I loved that version growing up, and it's still a cornerstone of my little sister's recipe repertoire. But as I'm a semi-New Englander, chowder is a semi-sacred thing in my book, with a few hard and fast rules. All chowders contain dairy. Don't give me none of that Manhattan clam chowder crap. Most contain potatoes, and some contain pork, all traditional and inexpensive New England products. I used to make my corn chowder with bacon, the most readily available cured pork product at the supermarket, but I was never too happy with its dominating smoky flavor, so I switched over to unsmoked salt pork, which adds the characteristic porkiness without overpowering the sweet corn. And some days, when I'm trying to feel extra valorous or have simply let my freezer run empty, I'll forego the pork altogether. Most chowder recipes call for sweating some onions in butter, adding your corn kernels, potatoes, and dairy, and letting it cook down. As it cooks, the potatoes release some starch, thickening up the broth. None of this bothers me. What does bother me is what goes into the trash, the stripped corn cobs. Anyone else out there go for 2 or 3 rounds on their corn on the cob just to suck at the little bits of sweet milk left in the cob after you've eaten the kernels? Like the crispy fat around a rib bone, that's the tastiest part. Why would you want to throw it away? Instead, I use the corn milking technique here, scraping out the milky liquid from the cobs with the back of a knife. By then infusing your base stock with both the scraped milk and empty corn cobs, along with a few aromatics like coriander and fennel seed, you can vastly increase the corniness of the finished soup. I mean that in a good way. It doesn't take long to infuse the stock, all of 10 minutes, which is just about enough time to sweat off your onions and corn kernels. Once you've got your corn milk stock made, the rest is simple. Simmering the onion, butter, stock, potato mix until the potatoes are tender, add some milk. I prefer it to cream, as the fattiness of cream can mask some of that sweet corn flavor, and then puree just enough of it to give the soup some body and help keep the butterfat properly emulsified into the mix. The great thing about this stock-infusing technique is that it's totally adaptable. Sometimes I feel like making a smooth and sweet corn velouté, which I'll make like my chowder, but omitting the potatoes and cream and blending until completely smooth. And if you do like the flavor of bacon in your chowder, go for it. Nothing's stopping you, except perhaps your cholesterol and your spouse. I, fortunately, have a spouse who can be plied with corn soup when I really want to get my way. Might I suggest you try the same? How to buy corn.